Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Isaiah chapter 42, which I will call the Lord's Chosen Servant. Lord's Chosen Servant, of course, is Jesus the Messiah. We begin now in Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 4. Yahweh is speaking here. Isaiah is speaking for him. And Yahweh says, "Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged till he establishes justice on earth. In his law the islands will put their hope." Now, who is Yahweh's servant mentioned in verse 1? Well, of course, that's Jesus the Messiah. Let me read you some learned opinion about that. Here's Adam Clark, who says this: "The prophet, having opened his subject with the preparation for the return from captivity at Babylon, and intimated that a much greater deliverance was covered under the veil of that event, proceeded to vindicate the power of God as creator and disposer of all things, and his infinite knowledge from his prediction of future events, and in particular of that deliverance. He went still farther and pointed out the instrument by which he should effect the redemption of his people, the Jews, from slavery, namely, a great conqueror whom he would call forth from the north and east to execute his orders." Now, Clark is saying in his fancy 19th century English here is that Isaiah has been talking about the return from Babylon in the previous chapter because of the Persian Emperor Cyrus, who was raised up from the north and east. But there's something further than that, and that's Jesus and the New Testament church. So Clark continues, "In this chapter, Isaiah proceeds to the greater deliverance, and at once brings forth into full view, without throwing any veil of allegory over the subject, the Messiah. St. Matthew has applied it directly to Christ, nor can it with any justice or propriety be applied to any other person or character whatever." So Clark is very emphatic that the servant that Isaiah is talking about is Jesus the Messiah. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say: "The law of prophetic suggestion leads Isaiah from Cyrus," that was in the last chapter, "to the far greater deliverer, behind whom the former is lost sight of." Now, in other words, Jesus overshadows Cyrus. The express quotation in Matthew 12, verses 18 through 20, which I will read in just a minute, and the description can apply to Messiah alone. Israel, also in its highest ideal, is called the servant of God. But this ideal is realized only in the antitypical Israel, its representative man and head, Messiah. Servant was the position assumed by the Son of God throughout his humiliation. Now, most all commentators agree that the servant that Isaiah refers to here is the Messiah. That's Jewish commentators as well as Christian. But even better than those commentators is the Apostle Matthew. Matthew 12, verses 17 through 21. In those verses, Matthew directly refers to Jesus, and he quotes this passage in Isaiah. So let me read that now, so that what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Matthew says, and here's the quote from the prophet Isaiah: "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul delights. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not argue or shout, and no one will hear his voice in the streets. He will not break a bruised reed, and he will not put out a smoldering wick until he has led justice to victory. The nations will put their hope in his name." Well, you will recognize Isaiah in chapter 42, verse 2 says, "This servant will not shout or cry out, and not raise his voice in the street. A bruised reed will not break. Smoldering wick he will not snuff out," and so forth. Matthew quotes Isaiah directly. So this is Jesus. This is who Isaiah is prophesying about. This is an easy problem to decide to whom Isaiah is referring. Now, there are some minority viewpoints. As Joseph Benson points out, some people have tried to say this servant was Cyrus, some people Isaiah himself, some people say the Jewish people. But no, it's Jesus. Here's what Barnes says: "This is so evident that it's the Messiah that Isaiah refers to, the servant. This is so evident that not only the generality of Christians, but the Chaldee paraphrast, which is some ancient text translation that takes it to be the Messiah, And divers of the most learned Jews understand the passage of the Messiah and of him alone. And these learned people pass a very severe sentence upon their brethren that expounded of any other person, and affirm that they are smitten with blindness in this matter. So in other words, you're blind as a bat if you don't believe this is Jesus that Isaiah is referring to. Now, Yahweh says in verse 1 that his servant, Jesus, is his chosen one. So Jesus is described as elect, even as Israel is described as elect in other places, even as the church is described as elect from the foundation of the world. Even the angels are called elect in some New Testament scripture, which I've forgotten right now. But it's interesting, even Jesus is called the elect, my chosen one, my elect one, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him. This reminds us of Isaiah 11, verse 2. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of counsel and strength, a spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. Isaiah 11, 2 refers to the Messiah according to the Cambridge Commentary. And the phrase in Isaiah 11, 2, I will put my spirit on him, is reflected here in Isaiah 42, 1. So God is putting his spirit on Jesus. And Jesus will bring justice to the nations. Of course, that hasn't happened yet. There's been a lot more justice since he's come than before he came, but the culmination and perfection of his justice, of course, has not arrived yet because there are still evil people in the world. In verse 2, Jesus the Messiah is said to not shout or cry out or to raise his voice. As John Gill says, the evangelist Matthew renders the word cry out as he shall not strive or contend in a disputatious way about mere words and things to no profit, or litigate a point in law. He shall bring no complaints or enter an action against any, but rather suffer wrong. Well, I think we have to be careful about that. Jesus did engage the Pharisees minutely and extensively. But I think what Isaiah is saying here is that Jesus will not be a revolutionary. He will not cry out, "To the barricades! Burn the city down." No, he didn't do that. He didn't raise his voice in the streets. As John Gill says, his voice was heard in the street in a ministerial way. He sometimes preached in the street, as in many other public places, but not in a clamorous, contentious way, not in an opprobrious and menacing manner, not in a way of ostentation, boasting of himself, his doctrines and miracles, but behaved with great humility and meekness. His kingdom was without pomp and noise. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that Jesus withdrew himself from the public fame created by his miracles. He made himself private. So in other words, Jesus was not about to start a political revolution against the Jews. So Isaiah's prophecy, of course, turned out totally correct concerning the Messiah. The scriptures show his modesty. Matthew 12, verse 15, when Jesus became aware of this, aware that the Pharisees were plotting against him, he withdrew from there. Huge crowds followed him, and he healed them all. But he withdrew when the Pharisees plotted. He was not trying to start a revolution. Now, there's some balance to this, of course. Although Jesus was modest, he was not afraid to stand up to the Pharisees. We read in Matthew 12, verse 34, "Brood of vipers, how can you speak good things when you are evil? For the mouth speaks from the overflow of the heart." So Jesus was no shrinking violet. He let the Pharisees hold it with every chance he got, and he sometimes, as people have pointed out, he deliberately provoked them to make a point, but he didn't try to start a revolution. In verse 3, Yahweh says through Isaiah that Jesus will not break a bruised reed. A bruised reed is one that's been damaged, and it's easier to break, so it's very, very weak. Jesus is not going to take a very, very weak person and break him. A smoldering wick he will not snuff out. A wick that is smoldering is about to go out on its own. It would be very easy to manually snuff it out. But Jesus, when he dealt with weak people, he helped them. He strengthened them. He encouraged them. He never destroyed them. Here's what John Gill says. But little light of joy and comfort, and this almost gone, and seemingly ready to go out, talking about a smoldering wick, and yet Christ will not extinguish it or suffer it to be extinct. He does not discourage small beginnings of grace or despise the day of small things. He blows up their light into a flame. He increases their spiritual light and knowledge, supplies them with the oil of grace, trims, snuffs, and causing their lamps to burn brighter. We go now to Isaiah 42, verses 5 through 7. This is what God the Lord says, He who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to its people and life to those who walk on it. Quote, this is what Yahweh is going to say. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles, to open eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. So when Yahweh says in verse 6, I have called you, he's referring to the Messiah, I've called you, the Messiah, in righteousness. Now in verse 5, God is said to have created the heavens and stretched them out, just like a tent when you stretch a tent out to sleep in it. God stretched out the whole sky. And God spread out the earth and all that comes out of it. He spread out the earth too, just like he spread out the sky. All that comes out of the earth, that would be the grass, the crops, the trees, and so forth. This God who gives breath to its people, that's life. Breath is life. That, of course, is in common with the animals. Some people say that the life he gives in parallel here, he gives breath to its people and life to those who walk on the earth. The life there is more than just animal life, but rather rational life. A rational spirit, a reasonable soul, an intellective faculty, a capacity of understanding, that which makes him distinct from animals. Some people say this is the Holy Spirit. God gives life to those who walk on the earth. He gives the Holy Spirit to them and gives them spiritual life. I don't know if Isaiah was going that far. He probably just is talking about how great God is because of all the life that God has created in the universe. In verse 6, Yahweh says, I, the Lord, have called you, the Messiah, in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand, as John Gill says, denoting his presence with him, the taking hold of the hand, and nearness unto him. God's near to the Messiah. God's favor and affection for Jesus, his counsel and direction of Jesus, the support and assistance that Yahweh gave Jesus, and the strength that Jesus received from Yahweh as man to go through his work. So God has taken hold of Jesus' hand as Jesus went through his passion, his sufferings, and so forth, in his ministry, his work. At the end of verse 6, Yahweh says, I will keep you, I will keep the Messiah, and will make you to be a covenant for the people. Well, how has Jesus made a covenant to the people? John Gill says, quote, Christ is a covenantee, a party concerned in the covenant of grace. And I'm going to substitute the new covenant there. A covenant of grace is a Reformed theological term with which I do not agree. Christ is a party concerned in the new covenant, the representative of his people in it, the surety, mediator, messenger, and ratifier of it, the great blessing in it, the sum and substance of it. All the blessings and promises of it are in him, and as such he is given. It is of God's free grace that he was appointed and entrusted with all this in eternity, and was sent in time to confirm and secure it for the people, given him of his Father. Redeemed by him, and to whom the Spirit applies the blessings and promises of the covenant, even the elect of God, both among Jews and Gentiles, especially the latter. In other words, Jesus is given as a covenant between the people. I assume he means the Jewish people there, and a light for the Gentiles. So there's a covenant between the Gentiles and Jews, between Jesus and those Gentiles and Jews, and that, my friends, is the new covenant. The covenant being this, you follow me, you believe in me, you accept my blood sacrifice for you, and I will release you from penalty for your sins. The new covenant in Jesus' blood. Verse 7, that new covenant is to open eyes that are blind, that's spiritual blind. Also, they were people physically healed too when Jesus ministered. To free captives from prison, I'm assuming that's spiritual prison. To release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. Of course, the Gentiles were in darkness until Jesus came and gave them light. We go down to Isaiah 42, verses 8 through 13. Yahweh is still speaking, and he says, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. See, the former things have taken place, and new things I declare. Before they spring into being, I announce them to you. Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the ends of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you islands and all who live in them, Let the desert and its towns raise their voices. Let the settlements where Kedar lives rejoice. Let the people of Selah sing for joy. Let them shout from the mountaintops. Let them give glory to the Lord and proclaim his praise in the islands. The Lord will march out like a mighty man, like a warrior. He will stir up his zeal. With a shout, he will raise the battle cry and will triumph over his enemies. Now in verse 8, Yahweh says, I am the Lord, that is my name. That's YHWH. We don't know how to pronounce Yahweh because there are no vowels. Yahweh sounds good enough to me. The Jews, of course, never pronounce the name, even to this day. And of course, name stands for all the essential characteristics and nature of that which is named. Yahweh, I think, means something like I am. I exist. I'm existence. That's my name. Jameson Fawcett Brown says the name is, quote, God's distinguishing and incommunicable name, indicating essential being and immutable faithfulness. Now, Yahweh, after saying that he was not going to give his glory to idols, of course, he says in verse 9, the former things have taken place. Well, what are those former things? Well, John Gill says the former things were previous events in Jewish history. Quoting from Gill, the things which the Lord had foretold in former times as to Abraham concerning the affliction of his posterity in Egypt, the bringing them out from thence and settling them in the land of Canaan, and other things by Moses and Joshua and other prophets and by Isaiah, and particularly the captivity of the 10 tribes, which was now come to pass in the times of Hezekiah. So basically he's saying all of Jewish history. But that's not the majority view by any means. Almost all the commentators say that the former things were prophecies fulfilled in the successes of Cyrus, all of which were mentioned in the previous chapter. Here are the commentators who believe that the former things were that. Cambridge, Barnes, Pulpit, Colin Delitch, Jameson Fawcett and Brown, Poole. So that's the way we're going to take it. The former things have taken place concerning Cyrus and his deliverance of the Jews from captivity in Babylon. But then in verse 9, Yahweh is going to declare new things. And of course, those new things are optionally, first, the return from captivity of Judah and Benjamin. This is the pulpit commentator's idea. So option number 1 is the restoration of the Jews from exile from Babylonia. Option number 2, the mission of Christ, new things. His incarnation, his sufferings and death and redemption and salvation. In my humble opinion, that's what Isaiah was talking about, new things. Colin Dillich says it's both the return from Babylon by the Jews of Judah and Benjamin, and also the coming of the Messiah. Jesus is the new things. In verse 10, Yahweh exhorts his audience to sing to the Lord a new song. I'm sure that's the song of the new covenant in the new Israel, in the new covenant, in the new Jerusalem. Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the ends of the earth, you who go down to the sea. That would be those who are on the coast of the sea and who trade in the sea by either catching fish or shipping goods out by the sea. Those in Phoenicia, namely the Tyrians and the Sidonians, were famous for that. And the people in those areas would receive the gospel message as it went out from Jerusalem to the uttermost parts of the earth. The people on the coastlands would, of course, be the first people to hear the gospel because of trade, because of the boats that traverse the Mediterranean Sea. And all that is in it, sing a new song, you islands. Of course, that's typically spoken of all the islands in the Mediterranean Sea. Cyprus, Crete, the Aegean Islands, Corfu, Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia, the Balearic Islands. Islands everywhere in the Mediterranean Sea, and they're all going to get converted as the gospel spreads all over the place. So that's referring to the peoples of the sea. In verse 11, Yahweh moves on to the desert. Let the desert and its towns raise their voices. Let the settlements where Kedar lives rejoice. Kedar is the Arabians, a clan of Arabians dwelling for the most part in tents, nomads. So now let the people in the desert rejoice. Let the people of Selah sing for joy. Those were the Edomites lived in Petra, which is a great place to go visit. It's on the United Nations World Heritage List. I've been there, and I still remember it fondly, even though it was a pagan city. It was really remarkable how much of it's been preserved. But at any rate, it's in the desert. You get outside of Petra, and you're looking at the Jordanian desert. But it doesn't matter Even the people there are going to rejoice. So we go from the sea peoples to the desert peoples. Everybody's going to be rejoicing because the gospel is universal. Let them shout from the mountaintops. Verse 12, let them give glory to the Lord and proclaim his praise in the islands. That sounds like the people of the desert are going to somehow go to the islands and the sea and give praise. Everybody's going to be praising together. Verse 13, the Lord will march out like a mighty man, like a warrior. He will stir up his zeal. That, of course, is talking about Yahweh overcoming the Babylonians so that they will no longer hold the Jews in exile. With a shout, God will raise the battle cry and will triumph over his enemies. Now, ultimately, of course, that is going to be in the new covenant, not just the Jews returning from exile. One is a type of the other. The Jews returning from exile in Babylonia is a type of Gentiles leaving the slavery of sin and coming into the kingdom. We go now to verses 14 through 17 of Isaiah 42. Yahweh is still speaking. He says, for a long time I have kept silent. I have been quiet and held myself back. But now, like a woman in childbirth, I cry out, I gasp and pant. I will lay waste the mountains and hills and dry up all their vegetation. I will turn rivers into islands and dry up the pools. I will lead the blind by ways they have not known. Along unfamiliar paths I will guide them. I will turn the darkness into light before them and make the rough places smooth. These are the things I will do. I will not forsake them. But those who trust in idols, who say to images, you are our gods, will be turned back in utter shame. Now in verse 14, God says, for a long time I have kept silent. What period of time was that? Jameson Fawcett Brown says it's during the desolation of Israel, during the Babylonian captivity, and I think that's probably correct. God has kept quiet, held himself back. Held himself back from what? Well, from vengeance on his enemies and Israel's enemies. For example, the Babylonians, the enemies of Christ. John Gill says it's the pagans of the Roman Empire. He doesn't mention the Jews up until AD 70, but that's all in the New Testament. I have a feeling he's talking now about the enemies of the Jews currently, which would be the Babylonians. So during that captivity, that lasted from 586 to 538. God didn't do anything, but then like a woman in childbirth, he cried out. And the Old Testament writers love that childbirth analogy. Pain, hollering, screaming. They didn't know about Lamaze, apparently. So God says he's gasping and panting like a woman in pain. Albert Barnes says that this gasping and panting here denotes the hard breathing, which is indicative of anger, or a purpose to execute vengeance. Now, John Gill says maybe it's gasping and panting in a good sense, childbirth in a good sense, because the ministers of the gospel are travailing in birth with Christ in them until the workers of Christ get Christ formed in the hearts of other men by regenerating and converting grace. I don't think so, because in verse 15, destruction comes after the gasping and panting. Verse 15, I will lay waste the mountains and hills. Now, I don't think we need to look for a literal time when God laid waste the mountains and hills of Babylon. It just means that when God starts destroying things that normally are permanent, like mountains and hills, that means he's really angry. So Babylon is going to get clobbered. The enemies of God will have all their vegetation dried up. The rivers will be turned into islands. As the rivers are dried up, the pools in the desert or on the ground will dry up. All of that just stands for the fact that God is extirpating his enemies. He is destroying all the remains of idolatry. Now, rivers and fountains are mentioned here, mountains and hills. Those are places mentioned as being sacred with the heathen idolaters. Mountains and hills, for example, were places where sacrifices were offered to idols. That's one way of taking the imagery. Another optional way is to say that Isaiah meant the removal of all impediments out of the way of his people. Just as he dried up the waters of the Red Sea and the Jordan River to make way for the people of Israel to cross, likewise, he's doing so now. When he says he turns the rivers into islands, dries them up, and dries up the pools, that's supposed to refer to the Exodus. I don't think so. I just think this is just a general expression of God's judgment on his enemies. In verse 16, God will lead the blind by ways they have not known. That would refer to the Gentiles before the light of the gospel came upon them. They were blind in knowing God, and then they're going to see by the light of the gospel among and along unfamiliar paths, God will guide them. I will turn their darkness into light. Isaiah says in chapter 42, verse 16, this is God speaking, and the way he's going to turn the Gentiles who are in darkness to unfamiliar truths, as John Gill says, in the paths of duty and truth, in the paths of faith, righteousness, and holiness, and in the ordinances of the gospel, which they were aliens and strangers to before. Obviously, the ways of the gospel are totally unfamiliar to people walking in darkness. That's true even today. People who are walking in darkness are selfish, they're blasphemous, they're lustful, they destroy their health, they destroy other people's health, they destroy relationships, they're bitter, they're vindictive, they're woke. Going to church would be a strange experience for these people. Do them a lot of good, but they won't go. Too busy destroying themselves and everybody else around them. So God says in verse 16, I'm going to turn the darkness into light. I'm sure that's referring to the gospel. He says, I will not forsake them, meaning the people who believe in the gospel. And then he contrasts those in verse 17, but those who trust in idols, they will be turned back in utter shame. So all of this is an expression of God's enmity with idolatry. Yahweh continues in verses 18 through 22 of Isaiah 42. Hear, you deaf, look, you blind, and see. Who is blind but my servant, and deaf like the messenger I send? Who is blind like the one committed to me, blind like the servant of the Lord? That's referring to Israel, the servant. It's not talking about Jesus anymore. Now it's talking about Israel, because obviously Jesus is not blind. Verse 20, you have seen many things, but have paid no attention. Your ears are open, but you hear nothing. It pleased the Lord for the sake of his righteousness to make his law great and glorious. But this is a people plundered and looted. All of them trapped in pits or hidden away in prisons. They have become plunder with no one to rescue them. They have been made loot with no one to say, send them back. So in verse 18, God talks to deaf people. He says, hear, you deaf. Well, who are the deaf? Probably Israel, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. John Gill says it's the Gentiles. Well, now, Isaiah has just blasted pagans, Gentiles. Now he's blasting Jews who are acting like pagans. We know that Isaiah has just finished lambasting the blindness of the Gentiles by reading verse 6 and verse 11 in this chapter 42. And verse 6 says, I, Yahweh, have called you for a righteous purpose, and I will hold you by your hand. He's called the Messiah for a righteous purpose. I will keep you and appoint you to be a covenant for the people and a light to the nations. The nations, of course, are the Gentiles who need some light because they're living in darkness. And then verse 11 in Isaiah 42, let the desert and its cities shout, the settlements where Kedar dwells. That's the Arabians. Let the inhabitants of Selah, that's Petra in present-day Jordan, sing for joy. Let them cry out from the mountaintop. So those are obviously pagans too. They're not in Israel. So now God has finished blasting the Gentiles for their need of light. And now he's talking about the Jews who are deaf and blind. So he says, hear, you deaf, look, you blind, and see who is blind but my servant. And of course, I'm assuming that's the Jewish people. There are some other options, or at least one other option, as to who that servant is who's blind. Some Jewish expositors say that the blind servant is Isaiah, and he's being called blind and deaf by his enemies. So we would read it this way. Yahweh says, ah, you guys are saying who is blind but my servant and deaf like the messenger I send, like Isaiah I send to you. Well, I don't think that's it. I think it's just easier to take it straight and say that God is saying that his servant, the Jewish people, are blind. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that not only are the Jewish people blind, their blindness exceeded even the blindness of the heathens. I don't know how you can prove that, but let's just put it this way. God is upset with all blind people, all spiritually blind people. They didn't pay attention. They had their ears open. They could hear, but they didn't hear. They didn't understand. God made his law great and glorious, but they didn't pay any attention to it. Verse 22, but this is a people plundered and looted. That would probably be the Babylonian captivity, as Barnes says. John Gill says it's AD 70 when the Romans did them in, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it's both AD 70 and the Babylonian captivity in 586 BC. I'm just going to assume for the sake of simplicity, it's the Babylonian captivity. They were plundered, the Jewish people were. Barnes says, quote, the Jewish people were regarded as a people selected and preserved by God for the purpose of preserving and extending the true religion. They were the messenger. In verse 19, God says, who is blind but my servant, Israel, and deaf like the messenger, Israel, that I send. Barnes says, why are the Jewish people called a messenger of God? Because they were regarded as a people selected and preserved by God for the purpose of preserving and extending the true religion. They might be spoken of as sent for the great purpose of enlightening the world as God's messengers in the midst of the deep darkness of benighted nations. Now in verse 19, we have a translation problem. At the end of the verse, Yahweh says, who is blind like the one committed to me? That's the NIV translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible note says that the Hebrew here is obscure. The Holman Christian Study Bible note says the Hebrew here is obscure. The King James has it as perfect. Who is blind like the one perfect to me? John Gill interprets that as saying that the Jews thought they were perfect by keeping the law. Well, we're not going to worry about that too much. I'm going to assume the NIV translation is okay. Holman Christian Study Bible says, who is blind like the one dedicated to me, which is close to committed. We'll just assume that's right. The Jews were dedicated to God, but they didn't pay attention to his law. They shut their ears so they couldn't hear. They saw many things, God working in their history, but they didn't pay any attention to it. And now they are plundered by the Babylonians, looted by the Babylonians. They're trapped in pits or hidden away in prisons, either in Jerusalem or maybe in Babylonia, I don't know. They have become plunder with no one to rescue them. They have been made loot with no one to say, send them back. We go now to Isaiah 42, verses 23 to 25, and we will finish this chapter. God has finished speaking, and now Isaiah returns to speaking in his voice, and he says, which of you will listen to this or pay close attention in time to come? Who handed Jacob over to become loot and Israel to the plunderers? That's obviously God did it because he was angry with them. Was it not the Lord against whom we have sinned? He was justly angry with them because they had sinned. He was punishing their sin. For they would not follow his ways. They did not obey his law. So he poured out on them his burning anger, the violence of war. It enveloped them in flames. Yet they did not understand. It consumed them, but they did not take it to heart. Now, if my house was burning down, it would be hard for me to believe that I could stand in the middle of it and not understand what caused the house to burn down. Sooner or later, I'm going to know. Might have to get a forensic expert or something to see if it was arson or maybe I left the gas on. But I'm going to know why my house burned down. But the Israelites, when their house was burned down, they didn't understand. They couldn't say, why are we going to Babylon? By the time they came back, they got rid of their idolatry, never to come back again, so God's punishment did purge idolatry from the Babylonians. Well, when they came back, they had been completely purged of their idolatry. They never committed it again, so God's fires of judgment did purge Israel of its sin eventually. But I assume Isaiah is talking about initially as they went to Babylon. They didn't understand that it was because of their sin. This is a helpful verse for those silly people who think that God is not a God of wrath. He's only a God of love, which is about 95% of the wussy-pussy evangelical church today. That portion of the church which is scared to death of the word judgment, scared to death of the word hell, scared to death we might offend somebody. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 42. We are now prepared to go in our next chapter to Isaiah 43, which I will entitle Israel's Only Savior. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.